You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of July 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, Greece finds an unlikely ally, the IMF, as Alexis Tsipras struggles to keep his Syriza coalition together. Kathleen Burke and Martin Plaut will be here to talk about that and more. Then,
let's follow the growing number of our states and cities and private companies who've decided to ban the box on job applications so that former prisoners who have done their time and are now trying to get straight have a decent shot in a job interview.
We turn our attention to the United States as President Barack Obama calls for a comprehensive reform of the country's criminal justice system. And following the Iran nuclear deal, we discuss the new opportunities on the horizon for Russia. All that, plus why Rwanda's president wants a third term, why Uganda's wants a fifth, and what that tells us about democracy in East Africa. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, on Monocle 24. So welcome, one and all, to Midori House. My guests today are Kathleen Burke and Martin Plaut. Kathleen Burke is a Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and Martin Plaut is a Fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies. Kathleen and Martin, welcome to you both. Just for a change, I thought we'd start the programme with Greece. The Greek Parliament is having a key vote today on whether to accept the proposed reforms in exchange for a third bailout package. Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras faces some opposition from within his own party, Syriza, but it's expected that the deal will pass. And Kathleen Burke, he had a bit of a boost today in some senses, in that the IMF, in a report that they perhaps didn't intend to be made public, explained that Greek debt was entirely unsustainable and there was no way that they'd be able to pay it back.
Well, there's a couple of things there, isn't there? I mean, when the Eurozone group, as it were, put together their demands on Greece, they expected that the IMF to put in. They expect the IMF to put in a major amount of the financing. The IMF had already told them that what they were trying to do was unsustainable, and if it was not sustainable, which meant that Greece would go over belly, they wouldn't be able to contribute. So now Greece is able to say, "You're forcing us to do all this stuff." And even the IMF, the great IMF, says it can't be done. And the really funny bit there, of course, is that Tsipras fought tooth and nail against having the IMF as part of the hovering overlord. And now, of course, IMF, as one might say, is on his side. I love it.
It is interesting, Mott, isn't it, that the IMF has somewhat belatedly, and to be fair to them, you know, they're not a monolithic organisation. There were people within the IMF who were uneasy about sort of the main stance of the organisation. But they are now saying what appeared obvious to many people, but what the Eurozone ministers seem to fail to deal with, is that this debt, however you want to dress it up, is, you know, Greece are going to be unable to pay it back.
Yes, but, you know, I think there are a couple of things to say about it. The first is, of course, one shouldn't forget that the IMF is there really as a sort of banker of last resort for the world. But in its founding charter, it was actually suggested that there should be as much pressure on debtors as there were on people who'd borrowed the money. I mean, on people who'd lent the money as who'd borrowed the money. It's never been implemented, but actually it's right there in the foundations of the IMF. They want to run a system that works. That is what they're there for, is to make the entire global system work. So there's no reason why they shouldn't say, hang on, this is not going to work. That's exactly what they're there for. But the thing that I don't understand is I seem to remember seeing all sorts of images of Lagarde being at the summit. Now, if she was there, what was she saying? Wasn't she making this clear? She must have been.
They had already seen her report, hadn't they? So they knew what the IMF thought. They saw that on Saturday. And so when they were meeting on Sunday, they knew exactly what it was. Could I make just one small point that actually complements Martin's, which is the idea that a national debt is an appalling thing is really not the case. Britain has had a national debt for two or three centuries. It's a whole part of a financial system. People want to get rid of some of their money. They buy some national debt. In due course, they send it back. So the concept of a national debt is not a bad thing. The question is, can Greece pay any of it back? But if people thought that they could pay it back, they wouldn't have to pay it back.
Let's stick on that point for a moment, Kathleen, because what has changed in the past few years to make the idea of a national debt so anathema to so many politicians?
Well, Margaret Thatcher, remember, had this moment of blinding revelation when she realized that you actually could pay off the national debt. And of course, she was famous for equating it with household expenses. I think possibly because they just got out of control. And in Britain, of course, it was the 1970s as much as anything when Britain had to call in the IMF as well, because public spending and the debt mountain had built up so much, people began to think it couldn't be controlled. If people think they can control it, it's okay. But it's also a conservative reaction to everything that happened since the 1920s, you know, when conservatives got trounced with the Depression. Then there was a whole two generations of those who remembered that and how appalling it was. Now people don't remember what happens when you're too conservative in your money getting and spending, and you remember how awful it is when people were too profligate. I think as a historian, it's one of the great waves.
Martin, it's been interesting looking at some of the coverage coming out from across Africa about this crisis in Greece, because whereas many people in Europe have been saying, I can't believe that the EU and the IMF could treat Greece like this, a lot of people in Africa have been saying, I can't believe that the EU and the IMF would treat Europeans like this, because they are very used to, you know, their own countries being dealt with this by international institutions.
Yes, and on our benefiting, reaping the rewards of having been given a damned hard time about 20 years ago. And in fact, if you look at the African growth spurt, a lot of it can be put down to the fact that the IMF and the World Bank actually beat the hell out of the Africans and improved their economies, and they have now done rather well.
But also, you know where I'm going with this. They did a bit of that, but also a lot of those structural adjustments weren't necessarily good for those African economies. And there's an argument that actually it was the debt relief that they all received around the time of the turn of the millennium that was a bigger boost to their economies.
I think that is entirely debatable. I don't think you can be certain about either argument. Both of them helped, but both of them helped, not just one of them. But I mean, you know, I think the thing we need to remember about the Greeks is that they have had five defaults since independence, since about the last 100 years. They've actually defaulted on their debt five times. So, I mean, you know, anybody who thought the Greeks weren't going to run up a whacking great debt that they couldn't repay, you know, haven't looked, and I'm sure Kathleen knows much more about this than I do, haven't even thought about their history. So, I mean, you know, nobody has to go to the IMF. You only go to the IMF because you've run out of money. So, you know, in those circumstances, nobody forces anybody to go there.
Well, no, but there's also the other argument here, which we've rehashed time and time again, but it's worth rehashing again, is that... Yes, okay, the Greeks are suffering for their decisions here. But what about the people that lent them the money in the first place? As you say, if it's so obvious that Greece was going to waste this money, what about the German and French banks that that made these loans at these stupidly low rates and have now been bailed out by us?
Well, indeed. I mean, both of them are in the wrong. But, you know, you can't. I mean, the Greeks also came in with a completely false bill of lading, shall we say. I mean, you know, they entered the euro.
A Trojan horse.
Yeah, well, whatever you want to call it. I mean, you know, there was just nothing that there were all sorts of lies that they put about with the assistance of the French, who wanted them in the euro. Well, they came in, but you know, it just didn't work. So I mean, you know, it's not as if they're you know, lily white, purer than snow, driven, you know, young virgins who've never seen anything wrong.
On the subject of France helping out Greece, the French government, the French Parliament has just backed this deal before, in fact, even the Greeks had the chance to do it themselves. Perhaps Kathleen sending a message that they want this to work and they're going to support Greece through this.
And they're standing up to the Germans and showing that Merkel can't cow them down. Yes, I know. Yeah, well, France has an awful lot tied up with Greece being successful here. And so obviously Hollande is going to do whatever he can to help this. The idea that sending this message to Greece will transform the situation, I think, is a slightly bit limp. But it's rather nice, I suppose, to see that Greece has some sort of backer. If I can just, being a historian here, two things. One, some years ago, a friend of mine left the Foreign Office because he was so bored. He was doing nothing but trying to deal with the 1892 Greek loan, which they weren't repaying. And then in 1948, while they were negotiating, doing the Marshall Plan in Paris, 1947, they were supposed to all gather their statistics on steel production. And the head of the committee went out for a short break to a cafe, and he saw the Greek representative there filling out the forms with all the statistics. And he said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Do you think Athens has any better numbers than I do?"
So much has changed in the intervening 70 years. Let's turn our attention now to the United States. Earlier this week, President Barack Obama called for a joint effort to fix the country's broken justice system. He asked for joint party action to propose measures to change the system, from reducing or eliminating mandatory minimum sentences to the use of solitary confinement and improvements to prisoners' conditions. The move, surprisingly, has highlighted a sensitive matter for American politics, where for a change, Republicans and Democrats appear to be happy to work together. Martin Plaut, for the last 20 years or so, maybe almost 30 years, America has had an incredibly strict justice system, not really allowing judges much leeway to judge. Politicians have been very clear about exactly what they should be doing. Do you detect that there is change in the air?
Well, I'm not enough of a specialist on the United States to really be able to comment on that, but it does seem to me that there is now a concern, partly driven by the cost of this, the rocketing cost of keeping these vast numbers of particularly Hispanic and African American prisoners in jail for, you know, almost indefinitely, is, you know, it's billions. And I think the government is beginning to say, well, hang on, you know, there are other things we could do. I think they were saying they could double the salaries of all the teachers if they got rid of if they weren't spending this kind of money. Well, that's a much more attractive option than locking up people forever and a day.
Kathleen, do you think that this is what we're seeing is the beginning of a big shift in American politics into how justice is viewed, or is that a slightly optimistic reading?
No, I think so. I take Martin's point, and I agree entirely. $80 billion a year for keeping young men in jail for 20 years and because they were caught with a bit of cannabis on them seems profoundly ridiculous, but a lot of states have that sort of law. What I think was interesting here is it was clearly in my mind, stimulated by a couple of events. One, of course, was Baltimore. And Ferguson and all these various, the idea that something is wrong, these people are getting killed and they oughtn't to be, and the justice system has something to do with it. And the other, of course, was the Southern Director of Prosecutions who said, we have to kill more. These people are doing things, they ought to be killed, we need to kill more. And practically half of the deaths in the United States were due to his requiring they be killed. That may be a marginally wrong statistic, but in terms of his intent, it certainly is not. And these both provided quite an emotional punch. I mean, it's like having, okay, you can have a royal commission. This is very worthy, but it's a bit boring. But if you have a royal commission because there's been a massacre and you need to change something, that will stimulate discussion in a way that a more exemplary but boring report will not do. I think Obama is riding a wave that was already, as Martin quite rightly pointed out, had already begun. But I think it has added stimulus by what's been happening lately.
Martin, I was at an event last night with the US Ambassador to London, Matthew Barzan, who was saying he talks regularly to sixth form students around Britain. He's spoken to thousands of them. and he asked them to write down on one side of an A5 card something that is negative about America, and on the other side something that's positive. And he said when he was gathering these all together, he was expecting most of the negative things to be, you know, Guantanamo, war in Iraq, surveillance, things like this. And actually, it was guns, it was police brutality, and it was racism. Do you think that American politicians might be quite surprised to know outside of America how much this plays into how they're seen?
I think they would be surprised. But, you know, you've got to look at the statistics. I mean, something like 13% of African-Americans use drugs, and they make up 32% of the, or 33% of the prison population. So there's this totally disproportionate number of young black men who are in jail. Now, you have to ask yourself why. What is going on? Is that purely racism on the part of the police, that they are just targeting these people and it's racial profiling? Or is there something else that's happening that I just don't understand? And I'm not sure. I really am not sure.
Kathleen, can this Obama-led shift survive a presidential election campaign that's coming up in the next 12, 18 months?
Well, I hope so, because the chairman of the Justice Committee in Congress, in the Senate, has already said that this is bipartisan, and we've been sitting in this room and talking about this. And so the foundation of a bipartisan approach has been laid. So, I mean, there's nothing going to stop Donald Trump saying, kill them all, the Lord will know his own. But the idea that it has started on a low-key, all-players-in approach gives me hope. I mean, we all know almost nothing, in a sense, survives a presidential and congressional election. But in this particular case, there's probably a better chance than some other topics.
Kathleen Burke, Martin Plout, thank you both just for now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. We're back talking about Russia, Iran and Rwanda and Uganda. Lots of stuff to come after this.
See that man sitting opposite you on the subway, lost in another world? Or the smart woman scribbling notes while having her flat white? Well, here's what links them. They're both listening to Monocle 24 on our robust new, upgraded, and free radio app that simply and seamlessly lets you tune in live or download shows for later enjoyment. Just think, you too could be settling back with wise words from The Big Interview, being briefed on the world of business with the entrepreneurs, or just enjoying great music with the sessions at Midori House. Come on, download the Monocle 24 app today, stick on your headphones, and have informed fun on the go. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
It's the show presented by me, Andrew Tuck, all about the cities we live in. The show that celebrates urban living, from tough-talking mayors and civic activists to the guy who runs a perfect neighbourhood shop and the woman who, come sunset, turns into a gorilla gardener. The Urbanist is the go-to show for anyone who wants to know what makes a great city, and also a rubbish one, and how good lighting or wise technology could shape their metropolis for the better. Join us every week for sparkling debate, global reports, and some agenda-setting interviews.
We have a chance to shape what the urban environment will be like for billions of people.
The show premieres live every Thursday, or you can subscribe to the program as a podcast at monocle.com or on SoundCloud or iTunes. The Urbanist, the program that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me here in the studio, Kathleen Burke and Martin Plout. Let's turn now to Russia. Following the announcement yesterday of the historic deal on Iran's nuclear program, Russia has been quick to react and spark some speculation on the implications this might have for its energy sector. With the introduction of Iranian oil in the market after sanctions are lifting, would this mean that Iran would be competing head-on with Russia in Europe? Kathleen Burke, it's one of those things that wasn't immediately obvious yesterday, but this might not necessarily work out so well for Russia as they would have hoped.
Well, obviously, Lavrov, the foreign minister, immediately announced what had happened and immediately said how great it would be to reinvigorate the industrial and scientific connections with Iran. And there's no doubt that they are a big player in Iranian nuclear power development. So in that sense, he says, you know, that they are excited about that, besides which Iran would be paying them money to do it. But you're quite right on the oil thing. On the one hand, when Iran comes into the market, almost certainly the price will drop again because it'll be oversupply, or at least a great deal more of supply than now. And secondly, Iran used to supply Europe a lot of its oil. Europe is very dissatisfied with Russia. It could be Russia will lose some of its expected markets. So it's a jolly good thing that Putin has turned to China.
Martin, it's also an issue for the Saudis as well, and it's, you know, there were many reasons why the Saudis are unhappy about this deal. But this is going to be the rather unsavoury cherry on the. I don't know where I'm going with this analogy, but it's going to make things slightly worse, even for the Saudis,
sourer,
isn't it?
Perhaps.
A sour cherry on an inedible cake.
Indeed, particularly as if the Russians find that their oil is falling, then not only will they put up their cooperation on the industrial field with the Iranians, but they also start selling on them all those lovely weapons that they make, and so you'll have SAM missiles disappearing across the border to Iran, and that'll help balance the books as far as the Russians are concerned. And of course, that would make the Saudis even more unhappy, since the one thing they deeply don't want is an even more powerful Iran on their border.
Could I point out, of course, that everyone's worried about an Iran-Saudi Arabian Cold War, but it was the US-USSR Cold War that kept us out of war. So a standoff might be rather better in the region than an imbalance of power.
Well, I guess it depends on whether actually the war is going to be cold or whether there's going to be a series of proxy wars. And also, I guess...
It can't be more than there are now.
Well, and whether there are nuclear missiles on
both
sides.
That.
Well, and I guess also, Martin, is the issue of, there might not have been any fighting between the US and USSR, but if you look at other parts of the world, there were certainly fighting between their proxies.
Absolutely. There was hardly an area that wasn't touched by it. But I thought one of the most interesting takes on this was President Obama coming out saying what a grand job Mr. Putin had done in helping them negotiate with the Iranians. And goodness me, perhaps we should put Syria next on the list. Now, there's a thought. If America could begin cooperating with the Russians over Syria, perhaps we'd at last get somewhere in the crisis. But that's been one of the things that's been lacking.
Kathleen, sort of 24 hours on from this deal being struck, obviously there was initially a lot of excitement, people saying what you would expect them to say, whether that was in Washington or whether that was in Tel Aviv. 24 hours on, how does the deal look to you?
Well, I think it's a very good deal. I mean, the point is Obama continues making the point that this is not about transforming Iran, it's not about transforming the Middle East, it's not about peace and whatever to everyone, it's about controlling the nuclear weapons. And in that case, it seems, well, I'm not a nuclear scientist, obviously, no one around this table is, but it seems pretty watertight, or as Kerry says, buttoned down. It's going to make an awful lot of people extremely angry. I mean, Netanyahu is already threatening to take it out militarily, which is a joke, of course. And Obama does say, if push comes to shove, we can take it out militarily. But I don't think it will come to that. I think Iran has got so much to gain from it, and the intrusive inspection is so great that I think it's at least for 10 years. It's a pretty safe. And with any luck then, Iran will have changed the way it approaches various things and won't be trying to secretly come up with a bomb, unless, as you said earlier, Saudi Arabia does.
We'll move on that on that rather daunting point.
Yes.
Finally, let's turn our attention to East Africa, where two presidents so far this week have signalled that they might be sticking around for a little bit longer. Earlier this week, Rwanda's MPs said they would be scrapping the presidential term limits. That's going to allow Paul Kagame to seek a third 7-year term in office. Although if you count all the years he had before his official term started, he's been there quite a while. And also in Uganda, Yoweri Museveni has said he's going to seek re-election as well. Martin, he's been there since 1986. I said at the beginning he's seeking his fifth term, but I guess it depends on how we count. Now, what's interesting, of course, with Museveni and Kagame, and there are a couple of others in that region as well, is that back in the late 90s, they were being feted by Bill Clinton and Tony Blair as the leaders of a new African renaissance of democracy. It's changed somewhat.
It has changed somewhat, and these people have overstayed their welcome just enormously. And sadly for Africa, things are getting worse. I mean, there was one small glimmer of hope in Burkina Faso when they put down their foot, the ordinary people, and said to Blaise Compaoré, "You are not going to be our president for life. You can go away." And they
27 years is long enough.
Exactly. But, you know, you have people like Robert Mugabe, 35 years. You've got José Eduardo dos Santos of Angola with 36 years. And you've got Equatorial Guinea's Teodoro Obiang Nguema, that great dictator, with another 36 years. So, I mean, you know, you have people who've been around for longer than I've actually been a reporter. And that is saying something, since I've now retired. You know, these people should go. It's just insane. But they say, no, my country needs me. And they find all these little wheezes to hang on.
Kathleen Burke, as an outsider, how do you view this? Do you think that actually, you know, it looks as if the steps that had been taken of progress some years ago, we've gone slightly backwards?
Yes. On the other hand, could I point out Nigeria, which actually did transfer power reasonably peacefully, just at their elections not very long ago. And there's still a great hope for South Africa. So the two largest and, well, most powerful and richest countries in the African continent, well, sub-Saharan Africa, are actually, in those sorts of terms, behaving reasonably well. No one likes having a lot of tin pot dictators with a lot of weapons at their back in charge of countries. There is, of course, absolutely nothing we can do about it, short of invading. And I don't think that's on anyone's books just now.
No.
And the other thing as well to point out, Martin, is that, you know, when we talk about, for example, Paul Kagame, he is actually still quite popular within Rwanda.
Who would know? There's no free press. You say the wrong thing about him, you end up literally with your head cut off. So, I mean, there's no way of knowing. And don't forget, he represents the Tutsi. They're only 15% of the population. If it was South Africa and all the Tutsis were white, you would know exactly what was going on in that country. It is a racial hierarchy that is running the place. And if I may just contradict Kathleen, we do not know that South Africa is a democracy. In my entire life, and I'm now 65, there has been one transfer of power in 1994 when you went from the National Party to the African National Congress. Since then, there has been no transfer of power. There have been democratic elections, and I'm not suggesting there haven't been won by the ANC, but we have no idea whether they would ever get to the point where they give up power.
Well, that's true. I hadn't thought of it that way. I was thinking in terms, of course, of change of those at the top, and Becky went easily without trying to bring up, mobilize power in the party.
That's absolutely true.
Mm. Martin, I'm always loath to generalize when we're talking about Africa, because you try to start any sentence saying in Africa and it all kind of falls apart. We don't talk about Europe in the same way. But are you detecting there is, you know, a pattern here, that what's happening in Rwanda can be linked to what's happening in Uganda, that can be linked to what's probably going to happen in Congo with Joseph Kabila as well, and elsewhere, those examples that you mentioned?
Well, there's certainly a toleration of that kind of attitude by the African Union. There's no pressure from the AU to force people out. The only thing they're opposed to are coups, and you can see why.
There was an interesting piece today in the Guardian, Kathy Burke, looking at what might happen in Zimbabwe after Robert Mugabe, suggesting we should all get ready for Grace Mugabe.
Oh my God! Yes, we could. That might be a lot less bloody than some of the people who are in the background challenging what they see as her overweening influence. What I don't think is that the opposition will all of a sudden come to power. Okay. In fact, it might be better if they weren't very large. It would be safer for them.
We'll leave it there. Kathleen Burke and Martin Plaut, thank you both very much indeed. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. Midori House was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Guy Lutz and Elena Nikulicheva. The studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Tom Edwards will be here next. And then at 1900, it's The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Jacopelli. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 here in London, 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.